Live and in color from the NBC News radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf Sup radio studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone show this evening. Well, hello again. I'm Rob Starr, along with Mr. Chris Stades, and we're your hosts of the Water Zone show. We appreciate you tuning in and listening, and we have a great show tonight. I have two great guests. One is our famous person, and that's Miss Chris Austin, who is the purveyor of Maven's Notebook. And I see the light blinking on the line, so she must be online with us.
Chris, are you there?
Yes, here I am.
Hey, Chris, so an interesting week, huh, this week in California politics. I guess I'm going to kick that off with the first question. Is Trump is promising a whole lot more water for California farmers. But then the second story I read on Maven's Notebook, hey, the snowpack is only 43% of what it was, what it should be in March. What's the story there?
No, if only Trump could order the heavens rain more snow and rain upon us. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah,
you know, Trump came to town and he signed this record of decision, which is to make these new operating rules for the state and federal water projects, which supply water to most of the state. And these new rules are, from what I understand, they are materially different. But depending on who you speak to, they're either really good or really bad. These types of documents get down to like really specific things, like, you know, how many CFS can go down what channel at what time during what time of the year. In other words, it's not the kind of document that even I, with, you know, doing this for, you know, 13, 14 years, I can't pick up that document and decipher really what it means. And it's difficult for most. There's a lot that kind of remains to be seen. But Governor Newsom felt that these new rules were less protective. The environmentalists seem to feel they are less protective. The water agencies seem to feel that the science supports these kinds of changes, and they're not really that big of a deal. And, you know, they obviously don't think that they're going to result in species going extinct. So it appears at this point that Newsom has sided with the environmentalists. So Trump signed these biological opinions. Newsom throws a lawsuit out there. And then we roll around to this week where the Central Valley Project, which is the main water project that supply water to pretty much most of the Central Valley, the Sacramento, you know, Valley, as well as the San Joaquin Valley.
Yep.
And they came out with their initial yearly allocation for how much water the farmers are going to get, and it's all really pretty small, 15% for those that are south of Delta, which would be most of the San Joaquin Valley. There are some exceptions to that, and again, we're having a dry year so far. As February remains dry, you know, it sounds, you know, increasingly silly to keep pointing out that it just takes a handful of storms every year that supply most of our water supply. But as time goes on, it might be time to get more worried. And certainly if we are sitting this time next month with very little snow on the ground, then definitely it will be time to be really worried. And I certainly would not suggest that anybody go and full on and use water in the most egregious and, you know, irrigate, you know, tens of thousands of acres of stuff right now. I mean, we need to conserve because we don't know which way it's going to go. But, you know, it could go either way right now. We just don't know. California has the most variable precipitation as anywhere on the whole North American continent. I could show you a map that would show you this. You know, back in Washington, D.C., where they make most of these decisions, you know, the precipitation kind of comes, you know, the same time every year and, you know, slightly varying amounts, but not like California. We can, and we saw this just a few years ago. We went from very dry to very wet, all in one year. And, you know, these swings are getting to be more prominent and more, you know, and they happen, I think, not only season to season or year to year, but also, you know, I mean, what are we experiencing now? We had 80-degree weather, yesterday and today, I think today was a little cooler, but certainly yesterday. And now here comes the storm, and winter's coming back. And, you know, there could be snow and snow in the Antelope Valley. I mean, the climatic or the weather swings are kind of extreme. So we don't really know what to expect.
Well, the big deal with everybody is to remember is use their water wisely and efficiently.
Yes. And we should do that all the time.
Absolutely.
Really. We shouldn't be, you know, looking up to the skies to see. But definitely in a year like this, you need to be careful. And if you're thinking about, you know, like I'm sure my husband is plotting, you know, planting annual flowers all over the front yard so he can stand out there, you know, with the hose and water them all freely, you know, that may be not a good idea to be planning that.
Oh. Well, there's always artificial flowers.
Well, yeah. Annuals are great, but they're thirsty.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Annually.
Yes, but, you know, my husband always hates us when we get into these dry years, and I'm like, no flowers.
Yeah. So the Maven's Notebook is full of three-letter acronyms or four-letter acronyms this week. So, you know, we got one guy asking us here, what the heck is SGMA?
Oh, Sigma, my word, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. The landmark groundwater legislation that's just now starting to be implemented.
Yep.
And boy, I mean, that's another thing that's going on. You know, January 31st, all the critically overdrafted groundwater basins, the ones in the worst shape, they had to submit their groundwater sustainability plan. So it seems like everyone except one basin got everything submitted, and the one basin had a groundwater sustainability plan submitted, but they did not have a signed coordination agreement on how those four groundwater sustainability plans would work inside that one basin. So now they have, they've been, well, you know, the State Water Board is the backstop. So DWR has alerted the State Water Board that there is one basin potentially out of compliance. So,
what are they going to do to that one?
Well, you know, if they can. It's kind of hard to guess at this point because we don't really know. Theoretically, they can go in and they can set up their own plan, basic plan for managing the basin until the local people can get it together. But it seems to me that at this point, the local people have put all their GSPs together. They are just missing one small piece of paperwork.
Yeah.
So It seems to me silly that the State Water Board would come in and say, okay, we're going to do our own plan and you can all pay for it till you figure it out. But
well, they'll have to, you know, the issue on that side is the state will have to sit there and figure out a plan before they implement anything.
Yeah,
so that's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
Right. And it's going to cost, things, you know, money.
Yes.
So it would seem to me that, you know, the best plan would be, you know, that basin better figure out that coordination agreement and get signed. And maybe they're just, you know, one of the hard parts about coordinating all the Sigma stuff is that all of these agencies have boards and those boards have meetings on every second Tuesday or fourth Thursday or however they map that out, and trying to get all the timelines, you know, okay, so we adopt this, but all these other boards have to sign off on it. And so in a lot of ways, what some of the managers were saying is coordinating all of these timelines, making sure we get these things approved so that it can all go back to the board to get approved at their regular meeting schedule, which could be, you know, the second Tuesday or the fourth Thursday. Maybe they meet only once a month. I mean, so it's been a big coordination issue for just, you know, if you have multiple groundwater agencies operating in the basin that have to coordinate, there's just this whole schedule of public meetings and everything that has to be followed. So maybe they've just fallen out of that and they'll get that agreement in. Or, you know, on the flip side is maybe the state wants to make a statement that says you got to obey these timelines. And so,
yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine that even if they get it in, the state is gonna say, oh, okay. I mean, there seems to me there'd be a fine. I mean, if you don't pay your taxes on April 15th, but you pay them on April 20th, IRS doesn't go, oh, okay, well, close enough. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but this. Yeah. Well, the state's different than the IRS, but you're exactly right. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, we will see where we're going, and this is, you know, depending on who you talk to, this is the end of the world, or there is a way out of this. I covered a presentation by a hydrologist, and he talked about, you know, kind of some of the themes and the different ways some of these basins are choosing to get to sustainability. Some of them are using recycled water. Some of them are sort of rerouting their surface water to use it more efficiently. You know, as he pointed out, it's not about using your water in the cheapest way possible. It's about using your water in the smartest way possible, and that might cost you something. But you should take advantage of that.
No, we
yeah. And then he said that, you know, for all these groundwater sustainability plans, you know, because you're going to be limiting how much the farmers pump, that you also need to be bringing in other elements that give them flexibility and ways to work with the limited water that they have. So you want them to be supportive and have programs that help farmers use water more efficiently, markets that help, you know, farmers transfer their water, fallowing programs, so maybe you say you don't plant and you give up your water and you get paid for that. There need to be these different things in the plan.
Absolutely.
To make them, you know, palatable so that, you know, everyone can work together and we can figure this out without huge economic
You got it. Well, on that note, that's perfect. We're gonna have to go into our next break and guest, and because he's gonna be on for a little bit. We pre-recorded him because he's in a different time zone than us. In fact, across the world. And but anybody wants to get information on Maven's Notebook, go to mavensnotebook.com, and you can be a subscriber. It's a great way to get up to date, more up to date than the government gets. Get them from Maven.
Hey, so, thanks, Chris. We'll see you next week.
Okay, take care, guys.
Okay.
Good evening.
All right, well, our next guest is coming all the way from Israel, and we pre-recorded this because it would be in the middle of night for him sleeping, so this is all for you.
Well, good evening. Our next guest is somebody special who I met a couple years ago, and he represents a good company. His name is Dov Avital, and he's in charge of research and business innovation for a company called the Metzer Group, and they're based in Israel. So he's at nighttime right now. We're recording this early in the morning here in California, but we are very blessed to have him on. And Doug, welcome to the Water Zone Show.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome, Doug. Hey, you got a very interesting story to tell, so maybe for our listeners we can start about talking about a little bit about why you chose or how you got into the industry and into the current career where you're at. Maybe tell us where you're from and begin there.
Okay, I was born in Uruguay. My parents arrived there after the war. We are grateful for a great welcome and that was a station, but as soon as the family could emigrate to Israel, we did it. I joined the kibbutz, and the kibbutz is in an area which doesn't have any natural resources of water. So in order to make some agriculture, we had to find innovative ways to create water. And at the same moment, the kibbutz industry was focused on plastics because plastic is, from all the manufacturing, the less work-intensive and more human resources-intensive. So we just enter into that business. We were the second company worldwide to enter into the drip irrigation business. And more or less since then we are dealing with that, being also farmers, but more and more focused on industry. And in Israel, we have extreme pride on trying to be innovative. We are not so cheap like the Eastern producers, and we are, don't have the efficiency of the U.S. or German big producers. So, but we have a lot of human resources, so we try to be innovative. That's more or less what we are doing. And having a global operation, which can support the community and the neighboring communities. We are, Metzer is in a Jewish Muslim area. We're very proud of the peaceful coexistence of the two communities, and we are the main employer in the area. So it's important also to keep it. The source of income.
Yeah, great story. So just so our listeners can have a little timeline. So when, about what time, what date was it, what year was it when you moved to Israel?
It was 1974 after the Yom Kippur War. Things that you do when you are very young. So I moved, I joined the kibbutz. I married a girl which was born in the kibbutz, so we are still here. In Israel, we follow our woman. We don't argue. We say, yes, dear, and we are happy since then. And her parents founded the kibbutz, and it's so for the children, and now the grandchildren, we have a community with deep roots in the place.
Have you always been in the same kibbutz?
I was in another kibbutz, but we chose her kibbutz, and we didn't discuss that decision since then. Yes, I was in another kibbutz. I moved to her kibbutz, and this kibbutz is, as I say, it's dealing with irrigation. So I joined the factory. I worked there for a few years also in the administration. I ran the kibbutz chamber of industries, which is about 10% of the industrial output of Israel, the kibbutz federation, the economic department, and then I came back to what I like more, which is manufacturing and development more than administration.
Yeah, I know people here living in the United States only see news that's filtered here in the U.S. and things, but you guys have an interesting situation. I know you and I have talked about it before, and I've read a lot of stuff about it. So, you know, people think that people in Israel can't get along with people who live next door to them, and that's not a truism. I mean, you have, in your organization, you have tons of both Arabic and Jewish people, and the families are like families. They go to the same weddings, they go to the same funerals. I mean, you're friends. You're human beings to each other, and that's something that should be applauded. I wish the rest of the world could be like that.
Yes, since the kibbutz was founded, and we have a very particular situation because the area where the kibbutz is established was actually never conquered militarily by Israel. It was transferred in the peace agreements of 1949, so we don't have a refugee problem. In areas with refugees, the situation may be different. And from the beginning, the kibbutz founders were very insistent, whatever progress the government brings to the area will be shared by all inhabitants, Jews and Arabs, as usual. Since the community started, we cooperated, we met each other, as you mentioned, as human beings, not as Arabs or Jews, as human beings. And very soon we discovered, or the elders discovered and transmitted to the new generations, that we share one basic motivation, all human beings, improving our communities and building a better future for our children. I think this is a universal message, not only Jews and Arabs, it could be any other group. When we look as human beings, basically we want to improve our communities, create a better future, a better world for our children, and on that basis it's very easy to cooperate once you understand that.
Hey, so let's get back maybe and focus a little bit on the water park, since we're on the Water Zone radio show. Just to tell us at the beginning, I asked, you know, how did you get into your career or your current position? Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, I went to all the positions from production floor to CEO of the company, and then tried to do it, as I said before, on a national basis. But my deep belief is that for a small country as Israel, without a lot of resources and without a big domestic market, we have to rely on the only thing we have plenty, which is human capacity. And since we don't have any surplus of water, the idea of how to do agriculture in a desertic country with very few precipitations, it forces us to develop, first of all, drip irrigation, and then using recycled water and using all the resources we have. And now we have a surplus of water. Israel has, even if the population is constantly increasing, and half of the country is absolute desert, we still have a surplus of water that we can even share with the neighboring countries, which also helps to ease the tensions, let's put it in that way. When people can make a living and can farm and can do advanced farming, then they are less prone to deal with other things.
So Metro was established back in 1970. Yes. And I know they wanted to get into the irrigation thing. What is the state of water in your part of the world?
Well, as I said, we use, for agriculture, we use mostly recycled water, sewage water that's treated. It's not treated to drinking quality, but to tertiary treatment. About Israel recycles now about 80% of our sewage. In our proper area where Metro established, 100% of the agriculture is with recycled water. And we are trying to prove also that gardening could be done safely with that water. We developed several techniques to avoid potential hazards of contaminations, bacteria, and any other issues that authorities may have. As I said, recycling and desalination, it means that we have plenty of water. We have all the water we need. Our national reservoir, which is the Sea of Galilee, which is not a sea, as a lake, but we call it a sea, it will be full in a couple of weeks, will be full, and the dams will be open for the first time in 20 years. So it means that the policies are working, even if we came after 6 years of severe drought. This year, as I say, with the rain, recycling, and desalination, we have surplus of water.
So you mentioned the most prevalent method of irrigation there is drip irrigation. What, in terms of innovation in drip irrigation, can you give us kind of a little history of how drip irrigation has evolved over the years since when you first came to the kibbutz?
And then also some of the products that your company has created.
First of all, you know, the farmers always want it cheaper. So the focus is how to do it is something more precise with less material and less production costs, having cheaper. And we have to understand the farmer is the weakest link of the value chain of the food process. The farmers feed the world and bear all the risk. And in most countries, they don't have access to insurance or to good credit. So they have to minimize the investment and maximize the yield. So we focus on maximizing the yield. In the beginning, in Israel, the motto was using less water or having more crop per drop. Now we understand when we go into a global scale that in order for other people to adopt the technology, we have to help the farmer to make profits. Nobody will invest in technology if he doesn't see a profit at the end of the day. So we try to minimize risk, to improve the yields, to not only quantity but also uniformity, being able to achieve better market prices, use lesser quality water, use marginal land, and the direction we are going now, since we believe that all this development should be done in conjunction with nature, not against nature, it will be recycling not only water, but also plastics. My estimation is that about 100 billion feet of one-season products or two-season products, drip irrigation products, are produced worldwide every year. And polyethylene, which is the basic material, is very novel, but it will decay in 500 years. So we are actively seeking for biodegradable pipes. We are actively seeking for recycled water, for having more accurate bringing water to the roots, to the place they are needed, not to any other place, but just to the root system, minimize the use of fertilizer. So all these technologies, this is what we're working in now.
Yeah. Well, some of your products that you make, I know you guys make the drip emitters that go inside the drip tubing. And most of our listeners only know that drip tubing is a piece of plastic pipe that has little holes in it. And what they don't, you know, there's a lot of technology that goes behind that. And there's two kinds of emitters that I know that you make. One's called a flat emitter, and then the other one is a circular emitter. And then some of them are pressure compensated, some have check valves and such. Can you kind of give a brief description on the difference between, and what is the benefits of having one versus the other?
Okay, yes. Basically, the best emitter will be a cylindrical emitter, pressure compensated. It will be something that you can probably not clog. We have these emitters working for 25 years in agriculture use daily and still working almost like new. But on the other end, people want, as I say, cheap emitters that can be used for one season and cover the cost. So we have tried to have all the range between them. You need a pressure-compensated emitters if you have long lateral length of pipe. If you have slopes and you want all the plants to have to receive the same amount of water regardless the pressure, local pressure. Cylindrical emitters will have a huge filtration area, so will be clog-resistant. But on the other hand, the flat emitters can be flattened, that's the concept, and can save volume on freight. The pipes are basically full of air when you transport them, so also part of the tendency is going to flat emitters for the cheaper applications and produce close to the market, so reducing the freight incidence. If you go subsurface, you will need a protection against roots intrusion and also about mud sucking, so will be what we call anti-siphon. If you go to hydroponic crops or you want to have a measure, or if in gardening you want to avoid the wetting of undesired areas, you will have check valves So we have basically all the variants that we could imagine for any crop, any situation, and any budget. And the idea is that we can ship the emitters worldwide, because the freight cost of the emitter is very cheap, and produce the pipe, extrude the pipe locally. We are very efficient at molding. Our new molds produce 3 million emitters a day per one mold, which is the state of the art. So it makes sense to have all the variations on all the models and all the different grades in one central, very efficient production facility, and shipping worldwide according to demand. This is our business model nowadays.
Hey, Dove, I got a question, because I've heard several times, or people have asked me several times, in relation to cylindrical versus flat emitters, is there any advantage one over the other for friction loss or length of pipe run, and that people take into consideration?
Well, you have to check every emitter carefully. As I say, it's more related to the construction of the meter, how much does it protrude inside the tube, so you'll have more friction. But as I say, in a cylindrical emitter, you can have it all the components very close to the pipe, to the pipe wall, so you have less protrusion inside the meter, which will result in less friction and more lateral length, and you will have bigger passages and more filtration area, including the ability of avoiding problems of the pipe twisting in the field. The pipe, even if you install it carefully, will have a tendency to twist according to how much is heated, the solar radiation, whatever, and you want to have the entrance of the water entrance toward the upper part of the flow rate, because the gravity will bring the debris to the lower part. So with a cylindrical emitter that you have two entries, 180 degrees opposite, you always have a clean entrance of water to the flow, the clean part of the flow. As I said, all the others are compromised, trying to minimize the especially the freight cost.
So you Metro has many factories, I guess. I understand you have one in China and Ukraine as well.
Yes, in Mexico, India, and we are now establishing in Kazakhstan, yes.
Oh, wow. You got a lot of things going out there. Now also, Metro makes the equipment to produce the drip lines. Is that correct?
Yes. Since we are a rather small company, and we are 100% owned by the kibbutz, we are not publicly traded, we don't have that access to capital that will enable us to create subsidiaries. And so the concept is to share our technology with local partners. We value very much the local knowledge of the market and the local knowledge of the users' needs and the users' habits. So we partner with the suitable companies or business partners in the world. Part of the companies are joint ventures, part are licensees that use our products, our technologies, our trademarks, and we try to keep in Metzer, in Israel, highly dedicated R&D facility, always dealing with new technologies. In Israel, we have 170 or 180 employees. 20 of them are engineers or technicians in water, soil, agronomists, plastics, electronics, everything. So we can supply all the components needed to efficiently produce drip irrigation. And our partners can have only the parts of research that they need. If we offer to our partners something and they don't need it, they don't pay for it. This is our big advantage. It's a bit like in the computer world. You have the Apple concept that everything should be under one roof, and the IBM will be more like that. We do the chip, and we do the machine to put it into the pipe, and we partner with, as I say, with local companies, and we believe that 1 + 1 is much more than 2.
So Doug, with all of that expertise and innovation and, the development and the production infrastructure that you have, service must be a big part of what Metroplast provides to your customers. Is that right?
Yes, it's right. We always have people flying all around the world. These days it becomes a bit more complicated, but yes, we provide support. We provide training in Israel and inside. And with the new technologies of communication, every extrusion line or every production line that we supply, we can have an immediate diagnosis of how it's working by remote control here in Metzer, and we even can alert our partners that something is wrong in the machine even before they notice that in production. So it's, yes, service as it.
Are you at liberty, Dove, to tell our listeners, and of course Rob and myself, about some of the current projects that are going on for Metzerplast or the Metzer Group right now, currently, and maybe even in the past, some of the more interesting ones from the past?
For instance, we share with Toro the license for Rootguard. And we are working now, since there is a demand in agriculture for organic crops, we are developing an organic anti-root version of Rootguard, not based on chemicals, but organic components, which is very exciting, very tricky, but very exciting. As I said, we started working on biodegradable pipes. There is a lot of talk about biodegradable plastics, but what people usually don't realize is that for bags or for whatever you use in daily consumption or cups, if you go to Starbucks, you only need them to work for a couple of hours. We need a plastic pipe that will work for at least a full season, will hold pressure, and will degrade it after we tell him to start it, and will completely degrade into the environment up to the molecules. So this is also something that we're working on it. We're working on immediate detection of anomalies in crops. As I said, since we have this culture of working with people, we're trying to give the agronomists and local advisors the tools. We don't want to replace them. As I said, we value very much the local knowledge. So to give tools to see in large installations when there is a malfunction, could be irrigation, could be fertilizers, could be pests, but in time this problem can be solved. We are working, as I say, since people want cheaper and cheaper, to increase the production rate, and we are working on a very exciting new cheap emitter that will enable us to offer 50% increase of production capacity at half the cost of current lines. So there are a lot of things going around. Not all of them are, we can speak freely. I told those that we are registering patents, also that legal department is working very hard to protect IP. It takes a lot of efforts to develop new products, a lot of failures, not only the successful one, you learn. So you want to protect your IP and, as I say, share it with our associates. Those are things we're working on, antibacterial pipes, since we work a lot with recycled water. There is a problem of bacteria accumulation on the walls of the pipe when you use that kind of water, and we want it to be a passive, completely passive protection. We don't want to change the quality of the water. We don't want to kill the bacteria. We want the bacteria to go to the field and be digested by the natural bacteria in the soil. So in addition to water, in wastewater, we will enable the bacteria in the soil to digest the nutrients and turn it into fertilizers that are usable by the plant. The nutrients that are present in the wastewater are not in form that the plants, the roots can take advantage of. So you need that bacterial cycle to do it. So how to prevent the bacteria from sticking the pipe by working on the field? Again, those are the kind of things that we are dealing with.
So now the question for me, Dove, is since you mentioned Starbucks, how many Starbucks are on the caboose?
No, well, Starbucks doesn't work in Israel. Probably the only thing. And we drink here. We drink here the traditional coffee. That's what we call the black coffee. We are in a mainly Arab area, and so we learn to enjoy that original coffee. We are very old-fashioned in regarding coffee.
Yeah. Hey, I know here for our residential commercial business, most of the size tubing that we produce for that market is 17 and 18 millimeter ID. But obviously you do agricultural stuff. What is the range of size tubing that they use for farming?
Mainly 16. In some places will be 20 millimeters. 18 is only used in the States. It's never used. I believe it's 5/8 of an inch or something similar. It's not used outside the U.S., but most of the real bulk of our production, I would say 90% of it, is 16 millimeters. We can achieve very good results with 16. Again, 20 will go to larger fields. Beyond that, it's we don't have the technology yet to offer a half a mile of continuous drip line or something like that. We did some research in 22 and 25 millimeters. There is a lot of pressure loss and a lot of lack of uniformity. We still are not there.
Oh, okay. So question for our listening audience that they wanted to know, does Israel sell water outside their country to their surrounding neighbors?
We don't sell the water, but we have agreements that we share water with Jordan and with the Palestinian Authority. Yes, it's part, since we are in the same basin, you can drive a border between people, but the water cycle doesn't understand, and the rain doesn't understand, and the rivers doesn't understand that. And the aquifers, of course, do not understand. And if you have a neighbor that will pollute his aquifer, your aquifer probably will be polluted too. So there is an interest in sharing those very vital resources in this area. As I said, there are agreements that we share water. Yes.
All right. So, Dove, maybe we can take a little forward look at what you see. Get your perspective, if you will, on what you see as the future of water, both in Israel and as it relates to the growth of your business.
Well, the paradox is that 50 years after we introduced the first companies introduced the drip irrigation, worldwide the penetration rate is 4% of the irrigated land, which is 17% of the agricultural land. So we're basically on 1 or 2% of the farming land under drip irrigation, which is completely baffles us. Why is that? We see large conversion, especially China, India, and Southeast Asia. When you want to control the crop, you cannot rely on rain anymore. It's if you look at the economic part of the business, not at the hydraulic part, the plants will be green. The trees won't die and the plants won't die. But if you want to have access to the premium market and you want to generate income from the farmers, you need the ability to overcome these climate fluctuations. The climate fluctuations are more extreme and more severe. Maybe that in average there is the same amount of rain per year or per decade. But if you want to have a very fine, from apples to vineyards to strawberries to whatever you want, You cannot rely, even wheat and corn, you cannot rely on rain anymore, because the crops don't know how to figure with average. If you have all the monthly precipitation in one day, which is happening now, the crops won't be able to take advantage of that. So drip irrigation or modern irrigation could be pivots in other areas, or sprinklers. It's everything according to the return on investment and the climate or the market, sorry. If you want to have insurance and you want to be sure that you can feed the population and also generate a stable income from the farmers, there is need to shift to modern irrigation. Water resources products is one part of the equation. The other is minimizing the use of energy. Energy is becoming more and more important as a cost for the irrigation. So we try to work with lower pressures. We try to use solar power pumps and solar controlled pumps. Yes, everything keeping in mind that at the end the individual farmer has to make a profit, and we have to remember that we're working to serve individual farmers.
I have a friend of mine named Seth Siegel. He was an author, but he also helped out with the government in Israel. And he's telling me, he wrote a book called Let There Be Water, and he was telling me that a lot of the crops are now being biologically engineered to be able to take more salinity, more salt in some of the water that's coming. And would that salt in the treated water affect the emitters or get stuck in those little emitter holes?
Well, we can keep that if we can control that. The polyethylene, the plastic, is not sensitive to the salinity. The only thing that we have to avoid is precipitation of the salts, so we keep the pH constant. And here, since we are talking about salts, which are basic on one hand and acid fertilizers on the other, it's quite easy to balance that. Basically, what we want is that whatever goes into the pipe, into the pump, and the pipe will go to the soil on the other hand. And we can manage with that. If we use surface irrigation, they will see a lot of salt accumulation in the surface because of evaporation. So this is another big advantage of subsurface drip irrigation, that we have the salt only in the roots area and not in the surface. And applying less and less water, it's also minimized the amount of salt, but we need crops that are, yes, more resistant. And even there is a funny story about tomatoes. Tomatoes irrigated with salty water develop sugars to protect themselves, so the tomato itself becomes more tasty after it's irrigated with salty water.
Huh. Wow. That's interesting. You know, one thing I see here in the United States, and I don't know if they have that in Israel, they call the term vertical farming, where they've taken office building or warehouse buildings, and they brought everything inside. From what I've seen on a couple of them, they reduce their water usage by 90%. Instead of solar or sunlight, they use LED lighting to substitute for the solar part of it, and they don't have much insects or disease and stuff. Is that something that Israel has looked into or are doing, this vertical farming where they basically grow it up in a warehouse?
No, we have plenty of desert land, and we are dealing to make crops in the desert. So this is our specialty. We have still plenty of desert to cultivate, and we have very hot climate, so it makes sense, and a lot of solar radiation, so it makes sense to take advantage of what we got. So say sun, this is what we got.
So, you know, for everything I've heard, it's like Israel turned the desert green.
Yes, it became green, as they were greening the desert. Yes, we can do that. And we can learn, as I say, as far as you remember working with nature and not against nature, you can do something that's sustainable. And each country and each region and each climate has to adapt its own solutions. We don't believe, and we learn that it fails. Trying to copy from one place to other doesn't work, but adapting the products and the technology to the local conditions and the local culture, it really works.
All right. Hey, Dove, I've got one more question for you, maybe centered a little bit on the beginning of the conversation. Here in the U.S., you know, we've got an 8,000-mile-away view of the Israeli-Palestinian relationship, and maybe we can get your perspective on what you see as the peaceful coexistence between the Arabs and Jews, how that influences you directly where you live and Metzaplatz.
Well, as I say, in our area, this is an example of people, Jews and Arabs, living in peaceful coexistence since the foundation of Israel. Here, most of the people favor a two-state solution. The problem is that usually the extremist minority takes control of the media and the dialogue, not the roots people. And it's not a cultural debate. It's something that's done with weapons. But basically, I believe that economic progress and more education will bring people to the understanding that they have more to lose than to win through wars. And nobody wins a war. All of us here in Israel had to be in the army. I was an officer in the army. So it's part of our nature, and we learn that in war you only lose. The key to the solution of the conflicts in this area will be increasing the welfare of the population, especially of the new generation, that they have access to better education, to better jobs, and better future. I believe that that will change minds. But I agree that whatever reaches the headlines, it's the violence, not the daily cooperation between people.
Yeah, I agree. The headlines for us sometimes can get confusing, right? We hear all kinds of different stories about the policy in the West Bank and what the Palestinian Authority is doing. So getting a perspective from someone in country is very valuable, and I appreciate that.
And I got to tell you, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I could spend hours and days with you about technology and things that which you've done and Metzer is doing. And we really appreciate you taking the time out, especially in your evening. I hope you're not late for dinner. I hope your wife's not angry at you for us keeping you away from that. But we want to thank you very much for being part of the Water Zone show tonight.
It was a privilege and a great pleasure, and I expect to see you soon in one of the shows.
You got it.
Right.
Well, thanks a lot, Doug. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was certainly a great interview with Dove, and learned a lot about stuff, what's going on in Israel and all the technology that they're developing.
Yeah, you know, great. And just to talk about all the things that they're doing with water over there and how important it is to them in such a scarce resource in a part of the world where...
You turn the desert green.
Yeah, where every drop counts.
That's right.
And really some great insight as to, you know, sort of the source bed of technology for drip irrigation.
Right. Well, just in case people listening, remember to go to your great store of Site One Landscaping. They make great stuff. And also take a look at products from Kellogg's Garden Products and Duraplastic Products. And they're wonderful sponsors to us, so we thank them for doing so. Yep. Any last words, Chris?
Nope. I think the final thing for us to say is...
do what everybody should do this week.
Keep our planet blue.
Good night, everybody. Right, we'll talk to you next week.
See
Have
you next
a great
week.
Week.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3.